I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Ida Kliter. She is an artist from Holland. She has an exhibition that is opening today at the Santa Fe Art Institute. It's called Acequias, and she is giving a lecture tonight at 6 o'clock at Tipton Hall on the campus of the Santa Fe University of Art and Design. Welcome.
Thank you.
And Diane Karp is here. She's the executive director of the Santa Fe Art Institute.
Hi, Mary Charlotte. Hello.
My most frequent guest on this program ever.
Good morning, Santa Fe.
Nice to have you. Now, you are from Holland, and you're working on Acequias. Do you have Acequias there?
Yes, we have Acequias, but they're called ditches or sloten. And they are the opposite of the Acequias, because we have too much water. The water has to get out of the country, out of these places to where you can grow food, vegetables, and here you need water.
So are we importing it directly from Holland? No, just kidding.
No.
If only no. We could. If we could make a balance in the world where excess water was channeled or funneled to places that were short on water and vice versa, that would make the world a much more livable place.
It would be very easy and very nice if only we could do that. But I mean, you, Holland is a lowland country. It's below sea level. It's known for its canals that in theory freeze in the winter. At least that's the image that we have from paintings and art history and so on. And the acequias that you have lead water from where to where?
They lead the water from... You have polders, it's called polders. So, okay, let's start. In all times, Holland was a sea. And then you have small little hills where people lived. And their names are Terpen. And my name is Kleiterp. So, my name refers to these first settlements.
So, your family probably goes way back.
I hope so. Well, I think so. But anyway, that's in the north, so that's to get dry feet. The main important thing in Holland is to keep dry feet. That's one. But climate is changing, so the sea level is rising, there are more rains, so we have to make new solutions for this thing. But if you're in the plain and you look at Holland, it's one flat place with all straight lines, and all straight lines are this acequias. So there were people in all times, 16th century. I'm not a water engineer, I'm an artist. But anyway, so they dried this land to grow vegetables. But because of the sea level, they had these circles around it, these lines around it where the water is in. So the water is going finally to the sea.
The whole center of Holland is farmland.
Right.
And it's communal farmland that is quite extraordinary. But one of the things that's so fascinating is that in Holland, they are constantly pumping water up and over dikes and out into the Zuider Zee.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Getting water from a lower level to a higher level requires...
Mills.
Oh, that's what all the windmills are for?
Yeah. Aha.
I should have known that.
Well, but that's okay. That's part of why we talk to people from different places.
And that's why. That's how they dried these polders. They had mills to get the water out, and then another mill, another level, more water out. That's the way it went.
And so they're continually conducting water out. And so how did you, as an artist, get interested in these acequias in Holland and then move to other places in the world?
No, it was the other way around. I was an artist in resident in Spain. I made self-portraits in the morning, and in the afternoon I had walks in the fields. And then I saw really beautiful forms. And they remind me at the work of Cristina Iglesias, a Spanish woman. And I thought, oh, this is her inspiration. So I was there for 2 months, and I want to integrate in this small village society. So I went to the ceramic class, and I was starting to make these shapes. And then a woman said, "Oh, my husband is making it." They were making ashtrays. And they thought I was crazy making this acequias. So she told me about acequias. So that was the start of it. So I made these clay shapes. I went back home. Then I started to make an artist book. Then I make these shapes again in other materials. Then I invited architects, and they said, "You will travel around the world." And I thought, this time more than 10 years, and I thought, we'll see. And now I'm here. And I've been researching the acequias and travel with the acequias around the world. So the acequias are coming from really old time. They're coming from Babylon. And then you had the Umayyad, and the Umayyad were a tribe, and they brought them back to, via Syria, they brought them back to Morocco, and from Morocco they went to Spain. That's where I saw them. And they brought them in 500, when Jews, Muslims, and Christians were in peace living together. Anyway, that's the idea we have now. And when you have Sinterklaas, that's the 5th of December, and I went to my grandmother, and there came a crate with big oranges from Israel. And so that was like a real treat. So when I was in Spain and I saw these oranges, because Spain was desert in that time, and then it became all these oranges, I thought, wow, this is really nice. So that was my inspiration.
And so how do these acequias work? Are they functionally the same in all these different places that you visited?
Yes. The nice thing is, and that's what I'm a sculptor, so what I like in my work is that you have something private or particular or individual, but you have also the global thing. So everywhere where you go, you will see this irrigation systems. They have different names, but they have the same thing. So there's a basin where there is rainwater in the mountains or snow, and then you go, it is without electricity or without anything, it flows.
By gravity, mostly.
By gravity.
It flows around the land, and so you have a big piece of land, so you get a lot of water for a long time, and I have a very small piece, or I am down. So the Spanish people brought them to here, but I think the native people had already a kind of same system. But they brought it also to Peru. So I went to visit Peru, and there they are from stone. So they're all from different materials everywhere. And there I visited a man, and he got just water once in 3 weeks for 10 minutes, and that was all. That was his drinking water.
In Peru?
Yeah.
And was that enough?
No, of course not.
Yeah.
So water is scarce. Water is... There will be probably the next world war about water. So what I like with this is to connect all these countries. So I made a virtual acequia trail you can see on the website. And especially for being here in Santa Fe and doing workshops with children about acequia, about water, I opened a Facebook page where everybody can put their artwork or what they see about water on this page. And I invited people from children from Peru and from Syria and from Japan, where I worked, and they put already their works on the Facebook page. So now that will be another trail. So I have layers of trails.
Very interesting.
One of the great problems is that water has been identified as an essential resource as we move forward into the future. And that creates a sense of competition that is, I think, unhealthy. And what Ida has been doing is using the acequia and the idea of the transport of water to connect children to share their common interests, so that it's a way of sort of countering that competition and demonstrating that water is something that we need to share.
Yeah.
Now, acequias here have not only an engineering history, but a social history and the times of year that you go to clean out the ditch, yes, and the mayordomo and all of that. Do you see similar things or different kinds of social structure arising around acequias in other countries?
No, I think the acequias are the first form of democratic decision-making, because you are in the same thing. You have to deal with each other to get the ditch clean, to get a good division of the water. Eh?
Right.
So that you see, I can see everywhere. I met in Peru a water committee, and you have in Holland the Dijkgraaf. We vote for him every, I think, 4 years.
And what's that?
Dijkgraaf. He's like the president of the water for the provinces.
Now, the water that is conducted out of Holland and into the sea, is that fresh water? Is that potentially drinking water?
Yeah, yes. I think so. But I'm not an engineer. I'm not sure. But
It is. It's certainly not salt water.
Right.
It's fresh water that they transport out into the Zuider Zee.
So, I'm in preparing to come here. There are a lot of people involved, and there is a man. His name is Jan Willem Janssens.
Yeah.
You know him?
He was just on the air a couple of days ago.
Okay, so if he knows everything about this.
He knows everything.
You can ask him.
Well, and one of the things that Ida is going to be doing while she's here, and it's one of the mandates of the Santa Fe Art Institute, Ida is our visiting artist for the month. And she'll be working with the acequia system of New Mexico up in Embudo and in Dixon, where the acequias are still fully functioning. She'll be up there doing workshops and talking with them later in the month. But on the 9th, which is Monday tonight, she's going to be giving her talk. And then on the
11th, I will go to school.
She's going to be at the Acequia Madre Elementary School doing a workshop with the children at the school to help them work with and better understand the whole functioning of the acequia system here in Santa Fe, which isn't any longer serving the purpose it once served, which was for agriculture.
Right.
Now we all have plumbing. But the acequia system is a deep part of our history and was not only a social communicator, it was a physical communicator. People would walk along the acequias to get from place to place.
It's part of the landscape. That's nice. So in there are countries where they try to install new systems, sprinklers or whatever, that's more economic, but that destroys the landscape.
And it changes the need for people to work together. And on the 21st of April, Saturday, Ida is going to be doing a workshop, leading a workshop on the acequia. The 21st of April is the day of the acequia cleaning. So the acequia madre cleaning takes place on the 21st, and her workshop will be at the rail yard. It's an intergenerational workshop that's open to the whole community. So people that would like to sign up for that can get in touch with Rachel Boothby at the Rail Yard Stewards.
Even grown-ups?
Even grown-ups.
I like the mixture of... I did a workshop in Syria this year, and what was last year? And about pomegranates, and I did it with grandmothers, grandfathers, and children. Oh, that's so nice.
What was it like there? You did a workshop on pomegranates?
Yes.
Tell us more about that.
So I had an acequia exhibition there 2 years ago, I think, and I met the ambassador, the Dutch ambassador. He came to visit, and we had dinner, and he said, oh, well, maybe you would like to do something else. And I said, okay. So that was decided in 5 minutes, and I came back next year, and I decided to work with grandparents and children, so and adults, and there was one theme, and that was the pomegranate. So finally, after 2 weeks, there was a big exhibition from all pomegranates in different materials from different ages. It was really nice.
So basically, people representing pomegranates.
Yeah.
In art.
Yeah.
In Syria.
Yeah.
Pomegranates are a gift from the gods.
Indeed.
They are remarkable.
I'm in love with the pomegranate.
So, and many cultures are as well.
Are there growing pomegranates here?
They do grow pomegranates in the U.S., not in New Mexico that I know of.
A good climate for it, I thought.
One would think.
I don't know. I just think of them in their sort of mythological significance.
Yes.
So when you go and show your work or the exhibition that you have opening today at the Art Institute, which I haven't seen yet, these are sculptures?
It's a trail made from... I translated these shapes for me, and they look like letters. And for me, life... if I look at these letters, I think, what does it mean? And if I look at life, I also think, what does it mean? Or what is the meaning of life? Or what does it mean? So there is hanging a trail on the wall, and there is an artist book, and there is a nice DVD, what is made by a very famous cameraman in Holland.
There's a video in our video viewing room. There's some photographs that are beautiful.
From all countries where I've been. So that's it. It's a small installation.
And you will be talking tonight and showing photographs of your Acequia work all over the world.
Yes, I will talk about the trail, the Acequia trail, but also my trail. My trail in art, so how I work. I start with my work. Then I will reveal what's what's there. I like to reveal secrets. I'm not good in keeping secrets. And then...
We love surprises.
And then I will do something interactive. Maybe... Shall I tell it, or shall we keep it as a secret?
Oh, I think it should be a surprise. But there's going to be an interactive piece to Ida's presentation.
Meaning more audience participation?
Yes.
It will
involve
the audience, yes.
Yeah.
It's quite wonderful.
That makes it fun. That's tonight, ladies and gentlemen, at 6 o'clock at Tipton Hall, which is right near the Santa Fe Institute. It's on the Santa Fe University Art and Design Campus. And for more information, you can call SFAI. You can go to sfai.org or call the Institute at 505-424-5050.
And if people would like to, after the lecture, they could come back to the Art Institute and see the exhibition and chat with Ida and have a light bite to eat.
Ida Kleiterp is an artist from Holland. We will see you tonight. Diane Karp, director of the Santa Fe Art Institute. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Ligia Cuevas. She is a photographer, and her photographs are in an exhibition called Vulnerable Dreamers, which is at El Museo Cultural here in Santa Fe, starting this Friday and running through the month of June. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much.
So this is a very sweet and beautiful and kind of interesting exhibition of your photographs of little Latino children here in the United States, children of immigrants. How did you come to this subject?
Well, as a background, I am a school teacher as well, and I do teach in Cincinnati Public Schools. I also taught in Boone County in Kentucky. So I was a teacher for English language learners, what we call ELL kids, or English as second language kids. This started hitting in my back, on my head, around living with them, teaching them, seeing the parents, seeing the backgrounds that they have, and how vulnerable they were at one point. And it became actually closer. The idea became kind of alive when one day one of the parents called me and said the father was being transferred to Mexico from Chicago. It was detained in Chicago. And basically was about to be deported to Mexico. And it was the mother and obviously the three kids, one of them my students. It was going to be fatherless from one day to another. The father actually had a legal residency. It was not citizen, but he had a legal permit to work. Somehow he forgot his driver's license, was driving back home from Chicago from a construction work, and suddenly zigzagged a little bit and was detained because he didn't have his driver's license. He couldn't prove that he was legal citizen. He was immediately sent to detention, and it fell off from there. It turned out it was within 20 minutes of being deported. So have social workers and a lawyer managed to get in contact with the judge and clarify everything. And, you know, there's three kids involved. But it was too close, too personal at that time. And I'm like, you know, there was a problem. And I'm like, wow. So I started thinking as an artist and as a photographer. I was like, okay, I would love to do something with photography and really represent these kids who my student was an American, born in the United States, English as his first language, and didn't know anything about Mexico or just related to their parents. But other than that, the kid was an American. I have seen since that day, I've been paying more attention to what's going on around. We have heard about more cases and start doing research about it. And then the idea just came alive. And one day we decided to start working on the project, which lasts probably about a year of really going after photographing the kids.
So are these children some of your students, or how did you find them?
Only a couple of them were my students. And the others were I literally crashed. Every 15-year-old party quinceañera there was around my neighborhood, I went to stores, asked permission to photograph them. I found them in the park. I found them in any other cities when traveling. I found them, and I asked permission, can I photograph you? And I found them in the grocery stores, in the supermarkets, you know, and little by little, the collection started becoming a collection of beautiful photographs. And I think they all had this strong sense of dignity and honesty, and they're all very powerful, in my opinion. There's a sense of honesty on them that and I believe a lot of people cannot see or don't want to see it.
Now, is that the quality? I mean, there's so many children. Are those the qualities that you were looking for in the children that you photographed, that honesty and dignity?
Actually, not necessarily. I was looking at the kids as they were in their local environment, and basically seeing just how they look. I was not trying to portray anything with them, but just to really capture how they look, how they're being perceived. But they're not a fabricated image like you see on TV and I say, okay, these are poor Latino kids, so they're kids who are not being attended or they're the minority group. I was trying to portray them as what they are, because they are not the minority group. They are American citizens, which happen to look Hispanic. And because that aspect, sometimes they are overlooked or they are treated like minority kids, but they're not.
So these children whom you photographed, there's little stories that you have with each one about your experience of photographing them. And you get such a sense of each child's personality, not only from the photograph, but from the little, it's almost like a poem or a little caption or story that you put with the pictures. And I wondered if there were any kind of favorite children or favorite little incidents that go along with the photographs.
Well, yes, actually they are. I'm so glad you mentioned that, because obviously in the collection, you eventually as a photographer, you fall in love with one or two or three that become your favorite. And there's a photograph of two little kids. They're two girls' best friends. And one was very outgoing. The other one was a little bit more afraid. So they were holding hands, and the little girl, the one that was more outgoing, when I said, yes, I want to be photographed, went and told the other girl, and said, you know, don't worry about it. Hold my hand. She's a very nice lady. And then when everything was happening, I said, okay, can you sit down over here? They said, don't worry about it. It's okay. Just smile at the camera. And then I was like, I photograph. There's a moment when you say yes. And the whole conversation is there. It's just terrific. There's another one that is called, and by the way, the two girls are called Linda and Anna. And there's another one, this one, I guess, my favorite. It is the youngest kid in the collection. Her name is Linda. She basically couldn't hardly even speak. Basically, I asked her, and I said, can I take your photograph? She did not say anything. She just said, mm-hmm. But it was like an affirmation and mm-hmm. But the whole picture of her was very deep image on his eyes and look at me like deep, like, really, why are you looking at me? Why are you looking at me? I think that's one of my favorite ones. There's a kid who is extremely happy who lost his teeth. And the only thing is, I said, hey, look, I don't have teeth. So no, I'm not kidding. I took a photograph. So it's just this energy that they have that is what I love about photographing them, that eventually it was not me, the photography expressing them or making them alive in the photograph. It was them actually coming alive in the photograph.
We're talking to Ligia Cuevas about her exhibition Vulnerable Dreamers at El Museo Cultural. You decided not to give them their real names in the exhibition and not to note where they came from. Were you afraid that they would be vulnerable because of the exhibition?
I was a little bit concerned that the kids or their exposure could be trouble for the parents, because some of the parents, they might or they might not be legal. So I didn't want to deal with the situation of getting them in trouble or making them expose, especially their family. I didn't want to even ask either. I assumed that there was a probability of the parent not be legal or be legal. However, when the parent can be illegal, because that's some of the cases that you deal with, especially in north part of United States, you see a lot of situations where the kid is American, born United States, the mother is a citizen, but the father might not be, which is, by the way, the case of one of the kids in the collection.
Right, and then that brings up the other part of the exhibition, which you have, as well as the little stories of the children, you have so many facts about immigration and Latinos in the United States. And one of the, I guess, really basic parts of what you're doing is exposing how important families are and what happens to children or what could happen to these beautiful children if one parent or the other were suddenly, or both, God forbid, were suddenly taken away from them.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's kind of tragic. And this exhibit doesn't, I didn't want the exhibit to be a political message, because it's not. It's basically just making aware that the policies that we take or the government takes also affects the kids. And the sad thing is that nobody is speaking for the kids. The kids don't have voice, even though they are, so the majority of them, they have the legal rights of being Americans. They don't have any voices, because if they deport their parents, they get deported too, to a country that they don't know, to families that they don't know, and getting with no friends of friends that they don't know. So it's, and they don't have any voice. So the main idea was to give the kids a voice and, like, you know, we are here. They don't know that there is an immigration issue either. So suddenly, for no particular reason, they suddenly say, where's my dad? And they don't have anybody who can represent them into the government. It's like, I'm here. Look at me. And they had to suffer the consequences of maybe a wrong decision from an adult. But, you know, and I think it is important for the government to not overlook what happened is like a change reaction, what would happen to the family, to the mothers, to the kids. And not only that, even to the aunts and the cousins. It's a change reaction that really affects a lot of people. And I think it's important for the government to really look at and think twice, or have some kind of mechanisms to deal with the situation.
In the various texts that you have about immigration, you point out, without doing it directly, but you point out the just ever-shifting sands of sentiment pro and anti-immigrant. For example, the Bracero program provided all sorts of opportunities for Mexicans, and then 10 years later they were kicking them out through a draconian Operation Wetback program, and then there were work contracts, and then there weren't, and basically the shifting tides of U.S. policy have to do with a lot of things, including public sentiment, including the labor market, but they seem somewhat arbitrary and not very fair either.
Exactly, yes. And it's a sad thing because there is history that proves that having a work permit like the Bracero program really increased the economy and at that time of California. So and I think for Mexico also was a good situation because monies were coming back and forth. It was not just, okay, I come over here and the monies go back to Mexico and there is nothing here. And the wetback operation, that is something that is just a terrible thing. And when they had to deal with people who was jumping out of the boat because it was worse to go back home than jumping out of the boat.
Yeah, you tell that story. They deported people. They put them on a ship, sent them to Veracruz, and people actually jumped off the boat and drowned. And then the people remaining on the boat mutinied, and there was a public outcry in Mexico, and they stopped doing it.
That is correct. That is correct. And the sad thing is a lot of the people that they were deporting were actually citizens. They did not care. It was like having a quota to deport. The government have a quota of sending 1,000 immigrants back home with no particular reason. Okay, we just, if you are or you are not, it doesn't matter, you look like, you go. So it was like, it was like having a dog, that was like the dog that you don't want to have, and you take it and you take it to the next town far away, so he doesn't come back. And suddenly your dog jumps out of the truck because he doesn't know what's going on, or it's worse than that. I think that was a terrible situation. And actually, more recently with Bush, when Bush was elected president, Vicente Fox, came twice to the United States to talk to Bush about the immigration program, and he actually suggested to have something like, it was like a work permit where the immigrants were going to be allowed to come to work with a permit that was going to cost, I don't know, $1,000. So there was going to be control of that person coming to work for 6 months, for 1 year, whatever it costs, and it was going to be taxable from the United States and taxable in Mexico. But at that time, November 11 came in and everything was distracted, so nothing came up out of that conversation. But the conversations were already started with a work permit, but they never materialized. And at that time, what President Evan Calderon finished his sexenio in Mexico, and that was the end of that program, at least of the talking program.
This exhibition, I think if people see it, would inevitably have the effect of challenging whatever prejudices people might be carrying around with them, because the children are just so lovely and so full of character. Where are you going to be showing this? It's going to be here at El Museo Cultural in Santa Fe. Is this also a traveling exhibition?
Yes, we are thinking in the next show will be at the National Museum of Mexican Art in Chicago. The main idea is to continue the exhibit with as many museums as possible. And thanks to Maria, the curator at the museum in Santa Fe, this can eventually kick out and be tremendously successful, and also with your help.
Well, it's a lovely, beautiful exhibition called Vulnerable Dreamers. It opens this coming Friday at El Museo Cultural and is up pretty much from now until the end of June. Photographer Ligia Cuevas, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Orlando Leibovitz and Ethan Bach. They are both artists, and they're involved in Video in the Dome 2012. It's a collaboration between the Institute of American Indian Arts and Santa Fe Complex that is coming up this Friday, and it goes on through Saturday. Welcome, gentlemen, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us, Mary Charlotte.
So what is the Dome?
The Dome is an immersive theater. If you can imagine a planetarium screen, but instead of the ball in the middle shooting out light, there's six projectors that are projecting one high-resolution image. And it's different than a flat screen because, the audience is sitting immersed in the screen is coming over them, and the sound is surrounding you. And when there's images on the dome and they're moving, it doesn't feel like the image is moving. It feels like you're physically moving.
Oh, my goodness.
So it's really this whole body experience. It's
and this is at the IAIA, Institute of American Indian Arts campus.
It is.
Way down south, even past the community college.
Right.
And, I mean, why do you have a dome?
We came up with the dome. Our former chair of New Media Arts was discussing, was at UNM Arts Lab and talking with David Bining there, and they have a dome. Theirs is a 15-foot dome. Ours is 24 feet, so it's bigger. And
you mean diameter?
Diameter, yep.
And also they started adjustable. It's one of the only domes in the world that can be raised, lowered, and moved.
Tilted.
Tilted on different angles.
That's true. And they started discussing how it would be for native people to be able to create content for this spherical theater, because so many native stories, creation stories, and so many native creation stories have to do with spherical objects, or just they're very nonlinear in the way that their storytelling exists. And so it makes sense to be able to not try to fit them into a box, but to fit them into the sphere.
That's so interesting. What have you actually found? Like, do native people use that medium differently than other people?
It still takes everyone time to understand it. I mean, because to fit something into a sphere instead of a box, when you're working on a monitor that's a box to create the thing, really takes a while for your mind to wrap around it. It's as if synapses in your brain that have never connected before have to try to connect. And so it's an interesting process, but it's amazing to watch anyone, native or non-native, to be able to create in this environment.
So when you're in the presence of the dome, like I said, I haven't been out there yet to see it, but are you sitting under it? And how far is it above you?
The dome for this presentation will be on an angle, what would you say?
25 degrees.
A 25 degree angle. And there are chairs, some of them that rock back and forth, and some of them regular chairs. So you're sitting not completely under it, but surrounded by it is a better way of putting it. And it is quite an immersive experience between the visual and the auditory portion of it. We, for this event, we have tried to do something a little different in the sense that most planetariums or domes, the video or the work that is shown is astronomical or in some way celestial. This event is really an attempt to create fine art, whatever fine art is. This is an attempt to create fine art for the dome. And the artists that we have invited are all artists who are video artists but have never worked in a dome technology before. So it's been a real experience for them, as Ethan said earlier, to kind of translate from a flat screen to a dome environment. And you can't just make something flat and project it on the dome. From a technological point of view and from an aesthetic point of view, it has to work differently in the dome.
Now, is there dome software?
There is. There's a couple of companies in the world that handle the dome community, I guess, in dealing with software. We have a Skyscan system, and so it does the algebra to be able to project the images on the dome, and yeah, it's pretty intensive.
So what are we going to be seeing this weekend? Let's talk about the event. It's Friday and Saturday, Dome 2012, Video in the Dome at IAIA.
Yeah, that's Friday and Saturday, April 13th and 14th, yeah. Well, we have a list of artists. There are three or four who are local artists with national prominence, but local, and then three artists that are from various parts of the country, one from Brooklyn, one from Denver, and one from San Francisco. And Ethan, why don't you talk a little bit about what you think the artwork is?
So a lot of it's experimental. It's not necessarily like linear storytelling or anything like that. It's more abstract in the way that they're executing their work. They're really playing with the dimensions of the dome because it's being projected on an actual three-dimensional object. You not only get to deal with the flat surface, but you get to deal with this surface that's can come towards you or away from you or move around you left to right.
I mean, just to be clear, we're watching the inside of the dome, not the outside.
The inside, okay. Absolutely. Cool. Yeah. And so they're really being able to use that to express themselves in a new way and use their techniques and their previous aesthetics to just bring it into this new environment. So there's a bunch of different types of things that we've laid out in a nice flowing sort of manner. Some of the stories are more about inner workings of stress or inner workings of different subconsciousness. And some of the works are more calming and peaceful and just really using the environment to evoke a feeling, evoke their story in sort of their own aesthetic.
Yeah, for example, Megan, who's in Brooklyn, her piece was inspired by a friend who I think was in an automobile accident. I'm not sure what kind of accident, but had some brain damage, and I guess is doing better now, but the whole inspiration for her piece, which is a totally abstract piece, was this person's, what happened to this person and how the mind works. Susanna Carlisle and Bruce Hamilton have a piece that is goes back and forth between abstract and figurative. They've done a lot of previous work with dance, and so there are figures in her work. And who else? Mariana Amster a piece also kind of goes between abstraction and figurative work. They all have different inspirations, you know. In the end, who knows where art inspiration comes from? That's a whole subject matter to be discussed at another time.
And all of them have soundtracks that go with the pictures, or I'm guessing the visuals come first and the music later, or they kind of develop together?
It depends on their process for each individual artist. Some of them are more heavy into the audio and sort of either the audio will come first or they develop them side by side. And some of them are mostly visual in how they develop their content. So they're going to develop their visuals first and then do the audio. And so it just depends on their own process.
Yeah, I think, for instance, Robert Drummond, who has a piece in the show, I'm not sure about Robert, but I think he must come at it from both directions simultaneously. I think there's an interplay between the sound and the visual that works for him.
So the events this weekend, they're going to be, is it like going to an art show where you look at it in your own time, or is it more like a performance where you have to be there to start time? And
we have looped attached the each artist work was at each artist was asked to do a 3-minute piece, so we've got between 18 and 21 minutes of work that will be looped so that the entire show is 21 minutes long.
Okay.
But we don't have people sitting in chairs and saying you enter and leave, you enter when it begins, you leave when it ends. If people want to stay through the whole process, they can. If people want to get up and leave for part of it, they can get up and leave for part of it. We have limited space. Ethan, how many what do you think the capacity of?
It's 45 seats.
So So if we get a big crowd, people may have to wait a little bit. But
right, for the loop to end and the next one to start.
Yeah, but there'll be art in the lobby, and so there'll be things to do other than just sitting in the dome. And what I found, we participated in Currents last year, and we'll participate this year in Currents Arts Festival. But what I found is people, once they get into the dome, they have a hard time leaving.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they'll watch, like, more than one loop of an event because people get so enthralled with what's going on, so.
It seems like, I mean, I haven't been, this is very interesting. I mean, just the fact that we have an art dome in Santa Fe that I didn't know about it. Nobody knows about this thing, or you guys know about it, is in itself a reason to go down there, but it seems like something where you could go into almost a trance or something when you're inside it.
Absolutely.
Now, Ethan Bach, you have work in this show. What? Tell us about your piece.
So my piece is actually going to be in the lobby, of all things.
Okay.
I am not doing something in the dome. But my piece is called The Royal Road Project, and there's a collaboration between myself and Charles VC and Craig Thompson, and it's about the El Camino Real Trail, and we documented it from El Paso up to Taos. And we spent a couple weeks traveling the trail, and we stopped at least every 15 miles to document the area and sort of take in the environment. And it's about the history and sort of, again, more of a documentation but an abstract look at the history and the intricacies of this trail.
Very interesting. Now, you teach at IAIA.
I do.
And what do you teach?
I actually teach students how to produce work for the Digital Dome. So
this Which is a skill that when they graduate...
Yeah, they'll be able to work in dome production, which there's a big need for. Yes. Actually.
It's a whole new world.
Well, there aren't a lot of people who know how to do it, and so...
But there's a lot of domes?
There's actually over 600 domes in the world. Now, most of them exist in science centers, so that's why most of the content that has already been produced is deals with astronomy or deals with very heavy science-based, and most of what's being created is for a fourth grade audience, because that's who goes to science centers.
So are we talking like what I would call planetarium?
Planetarium, okay. Right. But Digital Dome is specific to having the high resolution projectors and having that. And but there is a need, since it's a new technology, there's a need for people to be able to produce content for that work. And I think it's great, especially having a digital dome and have students working that are native, because then they get to have ownership of their own stories instead of having other people, non-native people, saying, oh, this is a great story, I'm going to tell it without consulting anyone or that
right.
sort of thing. Yes.
It's called Dome 2012 Video in the Dome, and it's at the Institute of American Indian Arts campus on Friday, this Friday from 5 to 8. And Saturday from 5 to 8. Also, the event is free and open to the public. Artists Ethan Bach and Orlando Leibovitz, and it's a collaboration between IAIA and Santa Fe Complex. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
And for more information, you can call 424-2349. You can also go to sfcomplex.org and iaia.edu. Thank you, gentlemen.
You're welcome.
Thank you.